not-too-distant future.
You just heard a lecture by the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History and Professor of Middle East History Emeritus of Stanford University, Joel Benin, on Understanding October 7th, 2023, and Israel's War on the Gaza Strip. This was sponsored by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon. If you'd like more information about the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, you're welcome to write them at jpaopdx@proton.me. And thanks again for listening to RadioZyme here on KBOO Community Radio. يلي خدتو محبوبي محبوبي تحت الله شو خليتو خليتو يلي خدتو محبوبي محبوبي تحت الله شو خليتو خليتو سبع مكاويب النار بالنار سبع مكاويب النار بالنار جوا قلبي حطيته علالة جوا قلبي حطيته علالة لا لا يا عمي لا لا علالة
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO hosts will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
Hey everybody, it's Marky Ramone here. How you doing? Catch me this Tuesday on the Ghost of Hollywood on KBOO 90.7 FM. And check out my show on October 9th at the Crystal Ballroom. We'll be doing 38 classic Ramone songs. And it's going to be a gas.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Laurie Mercier speaks with Juan Cole about Israel's motives in its war on Gaza from 2014. Jan Hocken and Mohammed Nabil discuss his anguish over loved ones living in Gaza. Patricia Kohlberg reads from The Intercept and The Progressive from last October. And finally, Jan Hocken and Kristen Hohl discuss documentary film Spaces of Exception. First up, Laurie Mercier with Middle East specialist Juan Cole about events in Gaza during Israel's 2014 war. From the archives, here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Juan Cole is Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. For three decades, he has sought to put the relationship of the West and the Muslim world in historical context. His most recent book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, and about a dozen other books about the history, politics, and culture of the Middle East. Cole is a public intellectual who writes frequently for Common Dreams, Truth Dig, Alternet, The Nation, and other publications, speaks regularly on radio and TV, and posts daily on his website, Informed Comment, Thoughts on the Middle East, History, and Religion. Thanks for joining us today, Professor Cole, and welcome to KABU.
Thanks so much for having me.
You reported this morning that President Obama compelled Israel to cease its attack on Gaza. Last night, Israel stopped its shelling of Gaza, but only after 2 weeks of killing almost 1,000 and injuring thousands of other civilians and inflicting much misery on what is already essentially a large prison camp. What are Israel's real objectives here? These attacks are not, as it claims, about Hamas and eliminating tunnels and rockets. What is really going on here?
The Israeli government was very upset when it managed to thwart John Kerry's peace initiative this past year, and the peace process, so-called, crashed and burned, that the Palestine Liberation Organization, which rules the West Bank, reached out then to Hamas in Gaza to form a national unity government. It's not much of a government, but there was a threat of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza somehow getting together and maybe even jointly going to the United Nations with a legal complaint against Israel for its continued colonization of Palestinian land. And I think, and many observers in the region believe, that the real reason for this attack on Gaza was an attempt to divide and rule, to keep the Palestinians away from one another.
And the U.S. Congress, of course, voting unanimously to support Israel's right to defend itself, and the U.S. media in general refusing to criticize Israel policies. You've even referred to them as Palestine deniers who are, if anything, more blinded and fanatical than climate change deniers. How is it that the U.S. media and Congress are so timid about challenging Israel and critiquing it publicly?
Well, I should say, first of all, that the media is diverse, and while American media has remarkable blindness to the actual situation of Palestinians, it does include seasoned reporters. One thinks of Ben Wiedemann on CNN or Richard Engel at MSNBC, who know exactly what the score is and have said so on camera. But Congress, on the other hand, is weird. The debates in Congress about this issue are so completely one-sided, and all you have to do is look at Prime Minister's question time on C-SPAN of the British Parliament debating this issue to see what a real debate would look like and what actual critical comment would look like. And why the U.S. Congress should be so one-sided on this issue is not a huge mystery. It's because the U.S. Congress is extremely corrupt. Our representatives are more or less bought and paid for. And the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a kind of umbrella lobby that organizes some 14,000 subsidiary lobbies, actively punishes any congressman that does anything but fawn over Israeli government policy by throwing its money to the other candidate. Most of our congressional races are relatively close, and even a little bit of money thrown to the other guy hurts. And the constituents in most of the districts in the United States don't really care about this issue one way or another, so it's single interest politics that pushes it. That's the same reason why the House of Representatives in particular is so one-sided on global warming issues. It's because big oil gives them a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. And because of this one-sided coverage or attention, most Americans may be in the dark about the rest of the world's condemnation of Israel's policy. And you mentioned British Parliament debates. But what is the rest of the world, including the UN, Europe, and the Mideast, doing to pressure Israel to stop its bombardment and its treatment of Palestinians?
Well, the rest of the world generally doesn't do much at all. The fact is that, you know, we're still seeing in international affairs great power politics and spheres of influence. And the world has recognized that Israel and Palestine is the United States sphere of influence. U.S. policy, in turn, really is governed by domestic considerations and single interest lobbies. And so that's why the situation is so intractable. The European Union has taken some steps to condemn Israeli settlement of the West Bank. Even during the last year, when there were supposedly peace talks going on that would lead to a Palestinian state, the land on which any Palestinian state would be erected was gradually being taken away from the Palestinians by huge Israeli apartment complexes. Bulldozers were being brought in, and huge building works were being carried out on Palestinian land that wasn't being bought or paid for. It was simply being usurped. And so the European Union has increasingly boycotted any Israeli enterprise on the West Bank and has insisted that the goods produced in the West Bank by Israeli squatter firms should be so labeled. And the British, French, Dutch, and other European governments have increasingly warned their own corporations and companies from investing in Israeli enterprises in the West Bank, because it seems clear that under European Union law, they could be sued by the Palestinians because what they're doing is illegal.
Well, let's talk a minute about the BDS movement, because it does seem like it's growing not only worldwide, but in the United States. And Noam Chomsky in the this week's Nation has expressed some skepticism about the effectiveness of boycott, divestment, sanctions regarding Israel, and whether this movement has the steam that the anti-apartheid movement had. What do you think is the effectiveness of the BDS movement?
Well, I think that the strategy is diverse among advocates of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. As I said, increasingly, you see in Europe even a mainstream consensus in government and business that Israeli economic enterprises in the West Bank itself must be boycotted, that what they're doing is simply illegal in international law and indeed in European law. And I think that's right. That is to say, companies that are primarily based in the West Bank or have a large presence in the West Bank, which are Israeli, are breaking international law, and it's not as though they have a license from Palestine to operate on Palestinian territory. And so I think that regardless of whether it's an effective strategy or not, with regard to the West Bank, I think it's just prudent and doing what is legal to sanction those companies. However, there are those who want to attempt to boycott and sanction Israel per se. And that's a more difficult proposition. Of course, there are Israelis, about 20% of the population, who are opposed to this particular war. In polling, over 50% of Israelis have said that they'd be willing to trade territory for peace. A lot of Israelis don't approve of the squatter settlements in the West Bank. So subjecting all of them to sanctions raises a lot of issues, and of course would cut the world off from peace groups like B'Tselem, who do essential work and might not thrive were they boycotted. So you had some of these same dilemmas with regard to South Africa as well.
And Israel's policies are, of course, dependent on U.S. support, are they not? The United States has a huge role in dictating what happens, and the United States could easily persuade Israel to change course if it was in the U.S. interest, or at least politically inclined to do so.
All the U.S. would have to do to settle this whole thing would simply to stop vetoing United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Israeli illegal activity in Palestine. And were it to withhold its veto, the resolutions would pass. And with regard to Iran, the U.S. was perfectly happy to make the resolutions a basis for a worldwide economic boycott of Iran. And with regard to Iraq, the United Nations Security Council resolutions were cited as a basis for actually going to war against Iraq, because they were flouted. So I think that were the U.S. serious about wanting to settle this, could simply stop running interference for Israel in world bodies. And I think one of the frustrations in Washington and Tel Aviv is now that the International Criminal Court, which neither the U.S. nor Israel has signed on to, but which has standing in most of the countries of the world, could well take up this issue in ways that the United States could not forestall.
Well, even though there is a ceasefire now, Hamas and Palestinian activists have said that even though there's a ceasefire, unless there is a serious political deal and an end to the blockade of Gaza, one can be assured that the struggle won't end sometime soon. Do you see any difference in the resistance this time compared to the last decade of previous attacks and resistances?
Well, the people in Gaza don't have any choice but to attempt to resist. The vast majority of them, over 70%, used to live in what is now southern Israel. Their homes, their farms, their property were all taken away from them, and they were chased out of them by militant Zionists in 1948 who quite deliberately engaged in the ethnic cleansing of the majority of the Palestinians in order to take over their land. And so the people there in Gaza were expelled and were crowded into, 40% of them still live in refugee camps. And then in 2006, elections were held for the Palestine Authority that Hamas won. It is a party of the religious right, doesn't recognize Israel, although why it should matter that a tiny population of 1.7 million doesn't recognize Israel, I'm not sure. But they didn't, and the Israelis found it unacceptable that they had won the elections. And so they kidnapped about a third of the parliamentarians, tried to destroy that government, overthrew it through a coup in the West Bank, and confined it to Gaza. And then they imposed a civilian blockade on Gaza. They don't let the people in Gaza export most of what they make, which, of course, has thrown the people into severe unemployment, 40% or so. 56% of families are food insecure. They're not starving, but they're a couple paychecks away from going to bed hungry. And the Israelis have actually connived at keeping out material necessary for infrastructure and daily life. They say they do so for security reasons, but it's obvious that they're basically engaged in collective punishment. They're using the children of and the women of Gaza, the non-combatants, as a bargaining chip, and their welfare is being bargained against, and their hope that that people will become so dissatisfied with this horrible situation that they will overthrow Hamas, and that Israel will manage to get a government in Gaza which will police the strip for Israel, and which will keep the population quiescent and make them acquiesce in their situation that Israel has dictated to them.
Well, in terms of this resistance, Juan Cole, we want to mention your new book, and you've written about the new wired generation and to what extent they have transformed struggles in the Middle East. Do you want to comment on how the internet and new social media have played a role in both Palestine and the global movement for peace and justice in Palestine?
Oh, absolutely. Well, if the first thing to say is that the Arab world, about 370 million people, i.e. larger than the United States, is very young. The median age is 24, and over a third of the population belongs to Generation Y, or the millennial generation, that was born from the late 70s through about the year 2000. that generation is, of course, the one that came to consciousness after the Cold War was over and at the time of the rise of the Internet. And so it is a generation that is particularly savvy about the Internet. In Gaza, the vast majority of the population is children and youth.
And so and that's something to remember as the bombs rain on Gaza, to remember that the majority are children.
Well, if you see apologists for this war say that the people of Gaza, you know, chose the war because they voted for Hamas, well, I mean, I'm sorry, but very few of them were of age that they could vote. And so they're nevertheless being bombed and crowded into refugee compounds and schools and so forth. The children are the ones that are suffering in all this. 80% of the people who have been killed have been non-combatants, many of them women and children. So the young people, you know, find themselves in this horrible situation of being blockaded by the Israelis. Many of them are not very happy with Hamas, frankly. They're not, their mindset is not that of the religious right. And they form a movement in the past year in Gaza called Rebellion on the model of the Egyptian militantly secular movement, which critiques Hamas. But during this war, I think the entire population of Gaza is suffering and hates what's being done to them. They have been assiduous in photographing and making videos of the extent of the damage that's being inflicted on them, and horrible pictures have come out of death and destruction. And, you know, in the old days, the Israelis could do these things to the Palestinians, and the world really didn't see it. It was only reported in print, which is much less visceral. And these pictures and this video and the personal testimonies and the pictures of the grieving relatives, all of these things, I think, hit the world in the gut in a way that the old print media couldn't. And I think it's had a big impact on the prosecution of the war.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us today, Juan Cole. You can read Juan Cole's comments daily on his website and blog, juancole.com, and in his new book, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East.
Viva La Vida by Coldplay here on KBOO Radio. That followed Lori Mercier talking with Juan Cole for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Up next, Jan Hawkins speaking with Mohammed Nabil from December 2023. Nabil is a Palestinian rights activist from Gaza. Here's Jan Hawkins for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Welcome to KBOO, Mohammed Nabil.
It's good to be here.
Well, Mohammed holds a BA's in school counseling and psychology and Middle Eastern studies, along with a master's degree in critical theory and creative research. You're now based in Portland, and you've been involved for many years as a Palestinian rights activist, formerly with Super. You can tell us a little about that group in a moment at Portland State University and Evergreen State College. So thanks so much for coming on to the Old Mall Variety Hour this morning and to talk about your own assessment of what's happening now with the Israelis' ongoing assaults on Gaza and what you bring from your own life experience from Gaza. Can you start by saying a little bit about yourself and what is happening with your own family now living in Gaza?
Yeah, I'm from Gaza, from Palestine, from Gaza, specifically in Khan Yunis. Khan Yunis is in the south of Gaza Strip. Yeah, I arrived to the U.S. about like 10 years ago. Now I live in Portland, and throughout like the last month and a half, or like we're getting into 2 months right now, I've been watching all of the atrocities that are happening in Gaza. I've been super worried about my family, super worried about my niece and nephews. Yeah, it's been very, very hard to communicate because of the lack of the internet, the lack of actual communication during the periods of blackout. And trying to do all of that and at the same time trying to lead a life here is immobilizing at its best, but it's never compared, and it's and not compared to what's the life is happening right now in Gaza. People and my family specifically are up to like the beginning of the temporary pause that been enacted in Gaza between Hamas and the Israeli government. It's been hell on earth there. It's imagine like 45 days of constant bombardment, constant fear for your life, constant worry, constant seeking for water, food, fuel, and everything really. And at the same time, trying to know like how many of your relatives and neighbors are still alive. So it's very, very hard to describe what's going on there unless you are there, but we can only predict and try to understand from the footage and from what I hear from my family and from the news, really. And that's like the hardest part, because Gaza is a blockaded area. You can't get in and you can't get out. So if even people want to go to Gaza and deliver support, food and water and medical supplies, they're not able to, because Israel mentioned that like you can't deliver anything without their complete approval. Otherwise, they're going to shoot it down. So that's the reality.
What do you know about and hear from your family and their community living there? Often the reports tally estimates of deaths and casualties. You know, these are important measures, but they don't capture kind of the desperate struggle for daily survival and the chronic forms of suffering that continue, including being, as you say, terrorized by bombings. And even during this period of a pause, knowing that it's a pause and that that itself can generate tremendous anxiety and suffering, even if you survive it and manage to live.
They call it a humanitarian pause. I wonder what we can call the resumption of the killing. So that's what it is. The reality is, by having this pause and putting us all in limbo and putting the Gaza people in limbo, they are stealing our future from us and stealing our presence. Because you're always thinking of the temporary, you're always thinking of the fear, you're always having your entire evacuation bag. With that, in Gaza, they have, every family has like a little bag that's like in case they have to leave or they got a notice that their home gonna be destroyed. They have this bag that has like the basic minimum of like paper document to allow you just like to identify yourself.
And I assume parents talk with their children about these plans as well.
Oh, yes. Here's the thing that's been happening in Gaza. In regards of the children, the parents have this hard conversation with them all the time. What should you do in case one of us have been killed? And that's a very, very hard conversation if you're a parent to have with your child, especially if they are really young and they have their future ahead of them. It's very emotional to talk about it, because that's been happening in Gaza since 2000, whatever, all the way up to this war. In this war, what's happening? Because like the mass number of killing, we're talking about, 15,000 people have been killed and murdered by the Israeli army, and 7,000 of them are children. So what developed this in terms of like how the parents are communicating with their children is the parents are inscribing the children names on their legs and their bodies. So in case they have a bomb or their house have been destroyed with them in it and nobody else survive in the family, the medical teams and the community members can identify who is the parents of this child and like how to identify them and to be able to take care of them in the future. So that's heart-wrenching, really, because no kid should have to go through this. No parents should have to go through this. And really, to see this imagery and this story coming out of Gaza and being in the U.S., knowing that our tax money is paying for this, is really unbearable, really. Because like there is so many ways that we can support the goodness of humanity without having to spend money on war and support Israeli crimes. That's one of the main things that make the U.S. a big part of this, because it's been over since October 7 up to now, and even way before, the U.S. has been the Israeli biggest supporter. And in a way, it's not in a way, it's officially, it's like a complicit with all of the war crimes that Israel is committing.
We are talking today on November 29th, which is the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, that was created through the United Nations in commemorating or recognizing the Nakba. And the United Nations General Assembly President Dennis France said today that the Palestinian people, as all human beings, are entitled to their fundamental and inalienable right to live in dignity with all liberties, freedom of movement, freedom from fear, and from any want, and with unfettered access to basic services. And so he calls today for solidarity with the Palestinian people in this Israeli war in Gaza. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that announcement today and whether you think it's meaningful. What does solidarity with Palestinians mean in the context of this war? And how should that be expressed other than in, you know, rhetorical statements?
Yeah, I think the UN's take on Palestine right now is it's more like immobilized because of how it's structured. So we have like all of the human resolutions, like the Palestinian resolutions from the UN that come that guarantee the Palestinian their homeland, guarantee the Palestinians.
And it looks very good when you read these documents.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, if you do all the UN resolutions, the Palestinian people will be happy, because we are nowhere near anything. Like, for example, the UN consider the West Bank as a state of apartheid with all of the settlements that are happening in Jordan Valley and creating an archipelago, if you want to say, of Palestinian territories surrounded by the Israeli settlements. And in order to go from Jerusalem to Hebron, for example, you need to go through a checkpoint. And that's the same case if you want to go between any two cities in the West Bank. The UN consider that illegal. And yeah, I consider that illegal. I don't think it should be. The same thing for the Gaza Strip. The UN consider the siege of Gaza since 2005 as an illegal and consider that a form of occupation, because like the Israeli government has been controlling every single aspect of life inside the Gaza Strip, including movement, including food, including airspace, including anything. In order to have any meaningful life in Gaza, you have to have the Israeli stamp of approval. And that's considered occupation by the UN.
Yeah. So with the United Nations General Assembly making these statements over a period of time, and it's not just left-wing or radical groups that are making these assessments of the situation, and yet making these same statements, if you are a student activist now, Palestinian rights activist, you know, there's tremendous censorship and repercussions to even making statements that are in the UN's own pronouncements. What is your sense now of this movement that's in some ways the largest anti-war movement in over 20 years, and where Palestinian rights are so central now to the struggles many, particularly people of color, identify with around the world? And so it's in a way a very hopeful time, but also so horrific and depressing that it's hard to feel any kind of light on the horizon.
I mean, the feeling is true. And like, it's very hard for me as a Palestinian, as much as I'm happy to see all of this support and all of, you know, like we have not seen as much support for the Palestinian people as much as we are seeing right now. And I think that is great. But at the same time, I can't look away from the life that's been destroyed in Gaza. I mean, the Gaza City in the north and Jabalia and the Beit Hanun, all the areas in the north has been completely destroyed. The amount of people have been killed and murdered are like unbelievable and unprecedented.
It's also the West Bank. Yeah, and what's happening.
Yeah, and the West Bank has been basically more than 160, in the last statement, more than 160 people in the West Bank have been killed. And that's been basically more number than the combination of how many people have been killed over the last 5 years. My main question here is like, how many Palestinian people we need to have in order to have more support? Why don't we basically make the support more permanent and more sustainable in terms of like not having to have more atrocities in order to have the support to come? That's like, it's been a very, very question for me as a Palestinian, questioning both realities, because yeah, I am happy to see the support, but at the same time, I'm very, very upset and very sad about the numbers and the loss that we are experiencing as Palestinian people. But I still have the hope, because with this assault on Gaza right now, what are people seeing is something crazy, for a lack of a better word, because they are able to see this happening over 45, 50 days now, and they're able to talk about it. They're able to have conversations. They're able to have discourse, and they're able to come down and join the streets and march for Palestine, contacting their senators and representatives on the state level and the federal level. So from that sense, I am hopeful, because I don't think that is going to go away anytime soon. And I hope that this will be like a start for a true Palestinian liberation.
Can you say a bit more there about both what you think the important demands are right now? We're here in the U.S., the pressure that we can exert on our own political representatives that are far to the right of the general public in this country on many issues, including on this one. Apparently, most people in this country, according to surveys, support a ceasefire, but that's still heresy for many politicians. So there's pressure on our own government, but there's also what we would want to support over time in whatever way this war is called to some kind of conclusion.
Well, there's so many ways. So for example, to start with, the most important demand right now is an immediate ceasefire. Now, and that is an ask, not just like for the political far right or far left, that is an ask from every single political representative in the government, in the Congress, and for Joe Biden himself, because we have only 47 Congress members, two from the Senate, and we have Jeff Merkley here is one of them, and we have 45 representatives
that are calling for a ceasefire.
That's for calling for ceasefire. So we need to make this number bigger, and we need to keep the pressure going, because in order to have any meaningful way to move forward, we have to have a ceasefire. We have to make sure that this is not just a pause, because we need to return the present and we need to return the future for Gaza in order to at least start breathe in order to go for what's after.
I just want to stay with that point for a moment. How do you respond to, you know, the Biden administration and even many Democrats who say, well, a ceasefire allows Hamas to reorganize and rebuild itself militarily?
What's happening here is Hamas has been in conversation with Israel before, and
right.
With Israel right now. How are the prisoners are being released from the Israeli prisoners prisons, and how are the Hamas hostages have been released right now? It's because there is conversations. Why are you able to have a conversation with them now and not want to have a conversation with them in the future? You've been having these conversations in the past before October 7th, and they've been attacking Israel before October 7th. They are there. Like, you can't just like ignore what's happening just because you are not able to eliminate them.
Yeah. And they've been abiding by the ceasefire. I know in some of the talk shows, there was all of this loose talk about how Hamas would never honor a ceasefire, it would only be Israel. Obviously, they're proceeding in a very orderly way and have complied with the agreement.
Yeah, they have been communicating. They have been cooperating. The demands are being sent to the U.S. and the hostages are being released. So if that tells us that there is a conversation and a conversation is possible, why keep killing? We don't know yet if Israel have achieved anything in Gaza according to that complies with their objectives. All what we know in Gaza right now is that 15,000 people have been killed. We have over 40,000 people have been injured. We know that half of the houses in Gaza is destroyed and half of the population is displaced. These are what Israel is doing right now. We don't know, we don't have any evidence that Israel have been achieving any of its objectives, but all of this killing and destruction that's happening. So it's time for this destruction to end and to start to have like a meaningful ceasefire and a meaningful approach to the future for the Palestinian people's safety and for the Israeli people's safety, because nobody wants to see any life to be spilled and nobody wants to see this destruction to continue.
Mohammed Nabil, can you say a bit now in closing about what you'd like listeners to be aware of? There's ongoing mobilization on the streets, but also people reaching out to their representatives. And it's so important, as you said, to keep pressure on our own government, particularly the federal government, but all our representatives, to demand a ceasefire and to support Palestinians in determining their own future without the boot of Israel on their backs.
Exactly. So I encourage all the audience to read about Palestine, to read about the boycott, divestment, and sanction in order to pressure Israel to basically acknowledge the Palestinian people and until Israel reach the demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, which is the end of the Gaza siege, the right of return for the Palestinian people, end of the occupation of Palestine and the West Bank, and also have equal rights for the Palestinian people who are living in Israel right now. There's 20% of the Israeli population who are actually Palestinian, who have been there before 1948, before the establishment of the State of Israel, and release of all the Palestinian prisoners in Israel. Like, there is more than 10,000 people imprisoned who are Palestinians in the Israeli prisons. Most of them are without even a criminal record or like a charge.
Another part of the story of Palestinian people under occupation and Israeli rule that you are learning more through this hostage prisoner exchange about how many young people are in jails in Israel under dubious charges or without
or no charges
formally
at all.
Charged. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mohammed Nabil, for joining me today on The Old Mole and for your work. And I extend my deepest heartfelt support and concern for your family and community there. I'm sure it must be so difficult, but and important for them to know that you're in contact with them and working here. And there are so many others here in support of Palestinian rights to survive and thrive.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Community Radio with Ariana Grande following Jan Hocken, talking with Mohammed Nabil for the Old Mall Variety Hour. Up next, from October 2023, Patricia Kohlberg looks at violence in the Middle East and reads excerpts from articles by Mehdi Hassan and Stephen Zunis. Here's Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg bringing you some perspectives on the Middle East crisis that you might not encounter in the mainstream media. Right now, it is difficult to uphold the idea that every nation has the right to exist in peace and freedom without being accused of supporting anti-Semitism, terrorism, or genocide. While insisting on these universal rights, we should also seek to understand what drives the conflict. Some analysts argue that behind the current outbreak of violence lies the neo-colonial strategy of suppressing progressive voices in favor of extremist regimes that the U.S. or its proxies can either crush or control. Mehdi Hassan, author and commentator, takes a deeper look at the rise of Hamas as a creature of Israel's own making. Here is a brief excerpt from his 2018 article in The Intercept titled, How Israel Went from Helping Create Hamas to Bombing It. He writes, "What do you know about Hamas? That it's sworn to destroy Israel? That it's a terrorist group? That it rules Gaza with an iron fist, that it's killed hundreds of innocent Israelis with rocket, mortar, and suicide attacks? But did you also know that Hamas would probably not exist today were it not for the Jewish state? That the Israelis helped turn a bunch of fringe Palestinian Islamists in the late 1970s into one of the world's most notorious militant groups? Listen to former Israeli officials, such as Brigadier General Yitzhak Segev, who was the Israeli military governor in Gaza in the early 1980s. Segev later told a New York Times reporter that he had helped finance the Palestinian Islamist movement as a quote-unquote counterweight to the secularists and leftists of the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Fatah Party, led by Yasser Arafat. Hamas, to my great regret, is Israel's creation. Avner Cohen, a former Israeli religious affairs official who worked in Gaza for more than two decades, told the Wall Street Journal in 2009. Cohen even wrote an official report to his superiors warning them not to play divide and rule in the occupied territories by backing Palestinian Islamists against Palestinian secularists. To be clear, first the Israelis helped build up a militant strain of Palestinian political Islam in the form of Hamas, then the Israelis switched tack and tried to bomb, besiege, and blockade it out of existence." That was an excerpt from a piece by Mehdi Hassan from The Intercept. Stephen Zunis, writing in The Progressive on October 11, details further how the U.S. has all along pursued strategies to buttress Israel's apartheid state in Palestine with deadly consequence in both Israel and Palestine. His article is titled, Hamas, Israel, and the U.S. Have Learned Nothing. Zunis writes, "The killing of more than 1,000 Israelis and internationals from rockets and direct attacks by Hamas is a staggering blow for Israel, a small country which has repeatedly been a victim of violent attacks throughout its history. But Hamas, once again, has failed to recognize that killing civilians is not just morally reprehensible, but politically counterproductive. The terror inflicted upon Israel will only harden Western support for the country and make it easier to depict Palestinians as somehow collectively guilty of atrocities against Jewish people. It will also make it easier to rationalize Israel's ongoing denial of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination, as well as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to consolidate dictatorial power through control of the judiciary. It is unlikely there will be a resumption of the massive pro-democracy demonstrations we've seen on the streets of Tel Aviv this year." While the Biden administration was certainly correct to condemn the attacks in strongest possible terms, it was incorrect in saying that they were unprovoked. Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem have bulldozed hundreds of Palestinian homes, confiscated Palestinian farming and grazing land, destroyed orchards and vineyards, engaged in arson attacks against Palestinian properties, and violated Muslim holy places. Israelis have killed scores of Palestinian civilians since 2022, and Hamas had been warning it would retaliate if they continued. When the Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, the secular nationalist Palestine Palestine Liberation Organization unilaterally recognized Israel and renounced the armed struggle in the hopes that Israel would allow for the creation of a Palestinian state. Hamas angrily opposed the agreement, arguing that the PLO was naive to think that Israel, with the United States as the chief mediator in the peace process, would allow for a viable Palestinian state to emerge. As Israeli colonization of the West Bank and political repression increased, and as the PLO-led Palestinian Authority became increasingly inept and corrupt, support for Hamas grew. The failure of the United States to be an honest broker and its ongoing insistence on providing unconditional support to Israel's increasingly right-wing governments seemingly vindicated Hamas's skepticism. In the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections, Hamas captured a plurality of the vote and eventually seized control of Gaza. They have ruled the enclave ever since, effectively banning any political opposition. Between 2008 and 2023, 78 Israeli civilians and 2,789 Palestinian civilians were killed in clashes between Israel and Hamas. Despite this skewed ratio, successive U.S. administrations and large bipartisan majorities in Congress have denounced Hamas's attacks while defending Israel's killing of Palestinian civilians, insisting that it was all in self-defense. Just as the lives of Israeli civilians were expendable in the eyes of Hamas, the Biden administration and a large bipartisan majority of Congress, like the Israeli government, may prove to be similarly dismissive of the lives of Palestinian civilians. That was Stephen Zunis, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, writing in The Progressive. Before that, you heard excerpts from a piece by commentator and author Mehdi Hassan, published in The Intercept. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Nicki Minaj followed Patricia Kohlberg's well-read Red from last fall 2023 here on KBOO Community Radio. Finally, for the Old Mole Variety Hour, here's Jan Hocken and Kristen Hull talking about documentary film Spaces of Exception. Here's Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Kristen Hull, associate professor in and director of the School of Film at Portland State University. She is the author of Towards a Feminist Cinematic Ethics and Decolonial Imaginaries in Palestinian Experimental Film and Video, Post-National and Feminist Aesthetics. Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Kristen Hull.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you on the show today to tell us something about the upcoming screening on October 22nd of the documentary film Spaces of Exception, directed by Malek Ramney and Matt Peterson. The film grew out of a multimedia project on refugees. Can you tell us about the film, about the project and the film, and why you're bringing both the documentary and the directors to the campus this month?
Yeah, so the filmmakers were doing this kind of ethnographic field work for a handful of years in southern Lebanon and the West Bank in Palestinian refugee camps, and then also around various American Indian reservations. And we're really interested in documenting these, just as the title of the documentary says, spaces of exception. So these spaces that are kind of in some ways outside of the regular order of things or set apart from, but are also very much regulated by laws and the violence of the law. And so they were exploring the connections, particularly between Palestinian refugee camps and American Indian reservations, because they're linking them as spaces that are produced by settler colonial histories. So they're the result of displacement of people or relocation of people, the reduction of their living space due to these like histories of colonialism. And I think One of the things that's interesting about their project is that they are not just looking, often the way that these spaces get talked about is kind of dark, you know, like they're spaces of biopolitical regulation or spaces where you can kind of see the way that the law has kind of marginalized, let's say, and de-resourced people. And certainly some of that is there, but the film is also really interested in capturing these portraits of cultural resilience and transmission that are happening and seeing this kind of positive aspect of like, yeah, just like the maintenance of culture, the persistence of culture. And I think that there's a joyful or celebratory aspect as well to exploring those cultures in these films.
That can be an important but critical source of tension, how you, on the one hand, you draw out histories of violent displacement and oppression and being subject to either genocidal or attempted genocidal destruction. On the other hand, how to also portray people living under these conditions of violent oppression as able to creatively survive and resist. And you can, I think, veer as a filmmaker either too much into the tragic side where it's as though all is gone and mourn and grieve that loss, or you can veer too much into a kind of triumphant, resilient tale. Sounds like there's some effort here to hold both of those poles.
Yeah, I think so. And I think particularly in the case of the Palestinian, which is the one that I have more expertise in terms of thinking about the representation of Palestine and Palestinians, there's a real reduction of Palestinians to certain tropes. And I think showing that kind of care and humanization, it's not just about suffering in these kinds of ghettoized spaces, but it's also about like what kinds of community are happening in these spaces, what kinds of culture building are happening in these spaces. So I think that's also an important contribution.
Well, much of your work, your writing and your teaching around film analysis focuses on gender dynamics. Can you say anything about that, how you would look at this film and the multimedia project behind it through a gender lens?
Oh, that's an interesting question. For me, I have a hard time separating my feminist politics, especially the more that I read, from a larger framework of decolonialism. And so they're not separate from each other at all. And I think a lot of the colonial project in both of these cases, looking at the colonization of Palestine and at the colonization of Turtle Island, has involved the reproduction of certain patriarchal gender norms.
And structures.
Yeah, structures, ways of thinking about taking land are often very gendered, and the kind of the narratives of the land being infertile and being fertilized by the European, you know, all of these kind of narratives. I think there's a lot going on in terms of gender there. That's not so much what the film is dealing with, but I think to me, this kind of like larger impulse to create a counter narrative to the colonial narrative and to speak back to that, and also to make those kinds of connections, international connections across these experiences, I think, to me, it's an inherently feminist thing, at least in my kind of definition of what feminism is. So,
and there's so much now on understanding the genocide that Israel's pursuing with Gaza and throughout much of the occupied territories, the forms of ethnic cleansing as part of a larger settler colonial project with commonalities. So I assume that there'll be some very rich discussion that's opened up by this project after the screening. Can you, in closing, say a little about where and when and how this screening is free and open to the public, but there's also another screening you're having at the Hollywood Theater. So give us that information.
That's right. So they'll be on October 20th, which is a Sunday at 3:30 p.m. And it's available on the Hollywood Theater website now. There's a live link there. So that's a ticketed, paid for ticketed event, but it'll be a screening of the documentary, which is about 90 minutes, and a discussion with Matt and Malik after. And then essentially the same event is happening at PSU at 5:30 on October 22nd. And that is open to the public and totally free.
And there may even be snacks there, free snacks.
The rumor is that there will be refreshments if you get there between 5 and 5:30. Yeah.
Okay. And that's Tuesday at PSU, October 22nd, 5:30 screening. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. Kristen Hull, professor, associate professor, and the chair of film studies at Portland State University, talking about the documentary film Spaces of Exception that we'll be screening in two places this month. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Van.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 7th of October, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Jan Hocken, Patricia Kohlberg, and Laurie Mercier, and to their guests Kristen Hull, Mohammed Nabil, and Juan Cole. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.